This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 24. And I am delighted to be joined on the show today by Nigel Verdon, co-founder and chairman of Currency Cloud, who have always been my FinTech Insider's FinTech of choice. He is now a partner at OGC Capital, Anglo-Dutch VCs. He also wrote last year an excellent penetrating account called So What is FinTech?, which I'll include a link to in the show notes. It's rare in any walk of life to find someone with such a breadth of experience that that in itself is a topic worthy of discussion. I last did such a show in LFP 007, Dotcoms to Fintechs, Lessons Learned by Mike Nolte, 40 years plus as an entrepreneur, investor and angel. And it has remained one of the most popular and certainly one of the most wise in terms of meta lessons, lessons about lessons. Nigel is slightly younger than Michael, slightly, although equally he has hit the ball out of the park in several different incarnations. In the UK fintech scene, we still have a hangover of what I call UK Fintech 2014. Sugar and spice and all things nice, fluffy bunny, and glossian fintech. Nothing wrong with a bit of sugar and spice. However, those fintechs that are making real waves in terms of hardcore facts such as business volumes, Currency Cloud, for example, recently passing 10 billion in transaction volume, a large number on anyone's reckoning, know that engines are all about hardcore engineering. Furthermore, fintech is not tech, it's more new FS, and financial services is far harder to get right than it appears. Nigel describes himself on LinkedIn as broad range of experience from tech guy to trader guy, with deep industry experience in capital markets, foreign exchange, international payments, and technology. Sadly, he also adds, what gives me a buzz is working with inspirational, like-minded people focused on a common goal. Well, that's a pity, as all he's got for the next hour is little or me, not in the least inspirational, and my only motivational tool is a big sign behind me right now saying, remember, it's all in the post-production. I can shuffle all your words around later if I wish to, so you better be nice now. So let's get on with the show, and in a few days' time, I'll decide how many of Nigel's words I'll shuffle out of order to change the fundamental meaning of whole sentences. No pressure then, Nigel. Hi, Nigel. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Mike.
So, as I was saying, you know a little bit or more than most about financial services, old and new. When did you suddenly decide that financial services was interesting?
It wasn't so much a decision. I started off my career as an engineer. I did engineering at university and ended up working in a company called EDS, a big technology engineering company, doing software essentially that sprayed cars and that type of thing.
Something useful.
I'm not sure it's useful, unless you like Vauxhall Cavaliers. A colleague of mine, Johnny Peacock, who's subsequently my business partner in Evolution, phoned me up one day. I'm leaving EDS and I've joined this company called Goldman Sachs. I had no idea what Goldman Sachs, who they were. Oh, this was when Goldman Sachs was still a partnership and still the original ethics of the firms. It's back in the early 1990s.
Those are the listeners who are sort of younger than about sort of 99. Back in the day, certainly in the UK, Goldman Sachs in the early days had an excellent reputation. I mean, on the corporate finance side, they would only do defences and M&As and all this kind of thing. You know, they came over sort of the most kosher of the lot. And as you say, things changed a little bit.
A little bit. But again, I still didn't know who Goldman Sachs was or what investment banking was, what capital markets or anything. I thought banking was you put a card into the wall and took cash out and you put checks into a cashier. And I thought the most sophisticated thing about banking was having a card that went in a wall, which was amazing in itself.
I haven't had time to catch up on the budget, which was just out yesterday as we record it, but I understand that George Osborne has moved on from this model and he now wants more ATMs to be able to accept the checks, you see. So banking has changed in the last 25 years. Okay. You can now put a card in the wall to get the cash out and soon you'll be able to put a check in the wall as well. But I thought you could do that for a long time anyway. What do I know about banking?
So Johnny gave me a call and said, hey, why don't you come and work in the banking industry? Because basically for the same maths we had as engineers, they'd pay you about 10, 20 times as much.
So you're actually a closet rocket scientist after all then?
Not a rocket scientist. This was just basic maths.
Okay. You're a car spray painting engineer. Yeah.
So I ended up working at Nomura and Swiss Bank Corp and discovered this whole area of capital markets. And around 1996, after working in the industry about 4 years or so, this thing called the internet appeared and everybody was saying, what's this doing? Magic things like email that were only internal things before then. You could suddenly email between different organizations and stuff. And Swiss Bank was a leading light in externalizing its foreign exchange business. to allow customers to transact with them over the most insanely intelligent piece of kit called a chat to negotiate option structures.
When was that roughly then? Was that mid-90s?
That was early 90s.
Wow. 1990s. That's very, very, very early then.
The very first sort of connection we did was between Swiss Bank Core and Jyske Bank of a leased line, because the internet was considered far too insecure at the time, but the same sort of technology and protocols. And that eventually showed how a sales guy could handle several clients at the same time on the FX sales desk instead of one phone. So there's a lot more productivity and a much more clarity that there wasn't things missed.
And absolutely. And fast forwarding many years, the fact that people are chatting online has become very relevant to the regulatory authorities recently,
yes,
in the foreign exchange markets, because people chat about all sorts of things online.
Yes, this was the origination of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's all your fault. Yeah. You put the spy in the cab at the beginning.
I then founded a firm called Evolution with my colleague who went to Goldman, another Goldman guy, and an old university friend of mine who was setting up ABN's equity derivatives business at the time, because equity derivatives was fairly new to a lot of people at the time, and to advise a lot of the investment banking industry on, as like a miniature Accenture, on how to externalize your front office processes and capital markets to your customers.
So this is very interesting. You know, in a sense, it partly explains why you've been so successful as you have, which is that you were really in there in the early days before it existed in any sense. You know, for example, going back to email. So I worked in a tech firm back in the day in Bath, and the what we'd now call the CTO of the tech firm, I remember being in his house, staying at his house in Bath for the weekend in the early 90s some stage, and he said, oh, this is things called the internet. I said, what's that for? And he was only just command line interface at that point. He said, oh, you can, you know, find out information and what's on other computers now. What do you want to do that for? He said, well, see what's useful. So I typed in Hawkwind, and it had nothing on Hawkwind whatsoever. So I literally remember saying to him, well, this is fairly useless then, isn't it? And he said, no, you know, well, it is now. It is now, he said. And he said, well, you know, what's going to be required is, it's very interesting, coming back to fintech, what's going to be required is micropayments, you see. He said, because once the micropayments, then people will start putting content out there. So, of course, he was completely wrong in a way, and actually became advertising ultimately.
Yes.
But, so I saw it in the early 90s, and even a tech person was having problems defending the utility of it. And in 1998, when I left Climate Events, and I was the last person in the whole group, showing what a Luddite I really am, not to use email. So my secretary would print them out and give it to me as if it were a memo. I would dictate a reply and she'd send it back. And everybody always laughed at the time of that, laughs about it now. But having said that, since using email for the last 17 years, that's a darn sight more efficient, actually.
Yes, I mean, sometimes it stops you replying too quickly. I think it's one of the downsides. You see technology and how it changes process, whether it's investment banking or any industry, is something like email. One of the downsides of it is too much information and a quick, unthought-through response. Over the years, just sort of try to discipline myself to try and minimise the amount of emails. Never write a big, long tome, because it's for short, sharp, getting something done. But also don't quickly respond, because so many people have done the wrong thing by that. Many war stories.
Going back to having had a proper education in banking, I remember in the early 80s being told the rule of memos, which is, if you ever write a very cross one where you're taking someone to pieces, stick it in your desk and come back the next morning.
Yes, yes.
But that, of course, doesn't happen these days. But it's interesting what you say about the emails, because my policy is only ever to write three sentences these days, and that's literally saved my life from last year. But emails have turned into texts, really.
Yes.
If you use them as an SMS kind of thing, it can work fairly effectively. But as you say, if you send someone two pages of A4.
It's interesting how, if you take, say, equity research or one of those other industries where the concept of email being able to get to your fund manager without having to talk to them and blast them out, then propagated into platforms which co-mingled all the research to make it easier for the fund manager to consume. So the ease of communication overloaded the consumer of the communication. So you had to build platforms to, again, disintermediate people again to make it more consumable.
Yeah.
So those cycles, I think, will continue to go round and round and round and round.
Yeah.
But it has led to a lot of innovation in financial services. Financial services have been one of the sort of leading lights in using new technologies. And I remember back at Swiss Bank Corp, we were one of the first, or we were the third biggest client of Next Computers when Steve Jobs set up Next Computers. And that was Linkdata's, the National Security Agency in the US, and Swiss Bank Corp. And the guys at the time, this guy called Dave Schomburg and others in doing technology, smuggled them into Chicago offices of the bank and were using them to pre-compute the essentially option surfaces that the traders were given on the floor the next day to say that's a buying surface, that's a selling surface. So it's almost like flip chart guidance for the risk management for the traders. So it's a very advanced way of viewing risk. And that was a culture at Swiss Bank Corp at the time. It was a big learning culture to live in. Then this internet thing comes along, you start using technology in other ways, which we did, to, as I said earlier on, to connect up to Yiska. That was, I think, the first exposure to fintech, was seeing how smart guys at Swiss Bank, it was amazing, this guy called Dave Solo, Craig Highmark, all well-known names now, just used technology in a way that other people just didn't.
For those who weren't in banking in the 90s, what you say was not just the view from inside the company, but also outside. So, you know, Swiss Bank Corp was one of the best ones at doing those things. I don't know what happened after it disappeared into UBS, it just kind of disappeared in a way. But it was ahead of the curve in that respect. And as I mentioned before, I did a little bit of risk in the 1990s myself and frankly really respected nobody else, largely because I'd been there first and I thought it all through and they hadn't even sort of worked out the mistakes. But the one book I did buy was called Risk in Banking Capital by SBC,
right,
which I've still got somewhere on my shelves.
Swiss Bank Corp.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they thought it through very well. I mean, unfortunately for them, they'd ended up with sort of mathematics, which is then very hard to communicate to sort of management and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
But they were a very solid firm. Just finishing off on the spray painting, because that keeps coming back to my mind. I didn't realise that you'd done that. So talking of risk, one of my issues with the whole industry, of course, is that you've got lots of, quotes, clever people.
Yes.
You start with option services, and before you know it, there's all sorts of funny things going on. And these so-called rocket scientists. But the problem with all those people is that, and this is where I think spray painting is very, very important, they never actually interface with any real world. It was always very numerical and very mathematical. The good thing about being an engineer, before we fast forward to, you know, what's interesting about currency clouds and FX and OGCs and all that kind of thing, the good thing about being an engineer is that you're clever at maths and all that, but you're well aware that actually, oh, we didn't spray paint the car after we spray painted a dog. You know, whereas yes. That didn't happen until roughly 2008 in banking.
Yes, yes.
You could keep spray painting dogs and nobody would actually notice.
Another thing, a dynamic that changed is, and there's all sorts of arguments for and against this, is when you took the trading off being a floor-based activity and the trading pits, where you saw the individual, you could almost see the risks around you.
Smell the fear.
See the liquidity. You got blackballed if you're doing the wrong thing. There's quite a clear community around that. It's like when banking was originally sought up in Italy, which was if you default on a loan, everybody knew about it.
Yeah, with bankruptor, bankrupt means they broke the table.
Oh, I've never heard that.
Oh, that's what it is. No, someone would come and smash your table in the market.
Right, okay.
And then it'd be pretty obvious to anybody else turning up not to deal because the table would be in too.
Then when they took it off the floor, there's a liquidity visibility issue, which people normally argue. Then there's also the issue of you weren't part of that crowd and obvious that you were doing something wrong or right. You're disintermediated, you're one step away when you're dealing just through the screen. And because of that, you lost a lot of the sense of wrong and right. One of the things that's interesting, technology probably put banking trading relationships back a bit, was suddenly behind the screen and not knowing the other guy at the other side of the transaction and the whole community knowing whether they're behaving or not. And therefore, I think that bred some behaviours in the market that have subsequently come in sort of 2007, 2008, and some of the causes of the issues we've had in the market going down, issues you've had with all the chat room and the manipulation and things, which wasn't an anonymous time. It's obvious if you did something right or wrong at the time, and the cameras on the roof as well fairly showed things as well. That technology didn't really help the markets in that way. It helped generate more transactions, but I think it took a lot of trust out of the relationship on there.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of how the financial services markets go and just making this parallel with the risk, you know, having been in risk at the beginning. On the podcast a couple of weeks ago, Giles from Zopra was accusing me of being cynical about risk. And I mean, he was partly sort of poking me in the ribs, and I'm sure partly he was sort of saying what he thought. It's not a question of cynical, it's just that if you're in at the beginning of something, you know what the strengths of anything are.
Yes.
And this is really useful for this, but equally you're much more aware of the limitations because people tend to forget those. Now you've been involved, as you say, in fintech right from the very, very beginning. And because of that, you were acutely aware at the beginning of the restrictions, which is actually, you ain't really very good at this kind of stuff. And these are the disadvantages.
Yes.
Fast forward and people forgot the disadvantages and there's all this excitement in press and, oh, it's all wonderful. Then, of course, what brings the house of cards down is that, you know, there's forgotten that actually one of the bits at the bottom isn't really there.
Yes, correct. Absolutely correct. It's a good analogy.
So fast forwarding then from digital markets at SBC, how does that all then move into the sort of the fintech age as we know it now?
I left Swiss Bank Corp, set up a business called Evolution, which my colleagues mentioned a moment ago. We sold that I was brought in by an ex-Swiss Bancor guy to the equities management team at Dresdner Kleinwort, Benson as it was at the time. And I think it changed its name three or four times within this short period of time. And DKIB was when I left there, that was what it was called.
So which years were you there then?
2003 to 2007.
Right.
The job was such to turn around the equities business with colleague Dave Wenman. We achieved that with a great team of people. And then I was thinking, what's next? One of the things that came up at that time is a colleague of mine, Sean Park, who now runs Antimus as an investment fund, was setting up a business called Digital Markets with Dresdner Kleinwort. And Dresdner Kleinwort, bizarrely enough, was full of ex-Swiss Bancor guys.
Well, that's largely because your Swiss bank friend, Arnold Ramji, had turned up in the late 90s
yes.
Head of what we used to call IT
yes.
When I was still there.
Arnold brought a whole load of ex-SBC guys. There was an equities, and they also in the front office, a lot of ex-SBC guys. And in the back office side, like Mark Doverston is an ex-SBC guy running operations there. So it was a whole, people of the same sort of culture and background. And one of the projects that Sean kicked off was, how do we make flow trading more efficient? Because generally you don't make a huge amount of money out of it because it's just volumes, smaller tickets.
Flow trading for non-FXC people means?
Flow trading is the bread and butter, simple credit, so bonds, corporate bonds, rates, which is government bonds, foreign exchange.
Plain vanilla trading.
Vanilla stuff, no options, nothing else like that.
Selling sterling, buying euros.
Yes, doing that, and you're doing that very simply. There's no issues about liquidity because there's lots of liquidity there. It's like Vodafone, that type of thing. The human being doesn't actually add any real value. The human being adds value when you're trading a large tranche of Vodafone, so you do want to minimise the impact onto the market when you trade it. So it was taking all that bread and butter, vanilla business, and putting the pipes in place, the machines in place to trade it, to market make it, and to transact it, settle it, clear it, etc., to make straight through processing of flow trading to make it economic again. And you have to be in the business of flow trading to get the more interesting trades, more interesting business that you make the money on. So it's one of those chicken and egg things. If you don't do it, you tend not to see the rest of the business you want to do as a bank, but you have to do it, and you have to normally use people to do it, and that's expensive, and therefore it's generally a loss leader to get the other pieces. So the precept was set up machines to look after it, do it economically at a price point, people point, etc., much more efficiently, 24/5 operation within foreign exchange, corporate credit, interest rates with government bonds, equity, and we also had listed futures, listed options, and prime broking in the same business.
So again, that's a classic sort of computery, internety thing, which is that in all industries, you've got some low value-added stuff.
Yes.
Where the margins get eroded, and it's not very efficient anymore. And then suddenly when I was a client once, that problem hadn't yet been solved, which is that people knew that, oh, the FX business, well, that ain't making much money. And it was kind of, what do we do about it? Because again, if you remove that, and then you knock something else down, and then you knock something else down, knock something else down, and then before you know it, you've upset the corporate financiers because they're no longer got anybody with them.
Sean set it up, Digital Markets. I joined him and brought the equity piece. So we carved out part of equities and put it into Digital Markets. We had JP Rangaswamy, who followed on as CIO after Arnold Ramji, who allowed the IT to report into the front office, and the front office set the bonuses of IT, which had to be approved by JP, but still. So he actually had control of the pieces for the first time in many, many, many years.
For anybody who hasn't got a background in financial services, you can't believe how radical that is. Because it goes back to the old day where there was a front office and there was a back office, and they're absolutely different empires.
Mm.
And originally, going back to when I joined Kleinwort in 85, they were based in different locations. I mean, the back office was in Reading, which then moved to Tunbridge Wells. And I'm sure people have seen on the television all these British shows about country houses. It was that mentality. It was the upstairs, downstairs. So there's this huge divide. And you know, the difference between upstairs, downstairs would be a bit like getting the Lord of the Manor to marry this sort of kitchen girl. It just would never have happened, actually. And it's amazing with hindsight how long it took for it to happen.
Also, it's interesting, the individuals who are in Dresdner Kleinwort at that time. JP Rangaswamy left. He was then followed Alan Lord to BT, but then became chief scientist at Salesforce.com. Reporting directly into Mark Benioff. He's now head of digital at Deutsche Bank. Sean set up Antimus, which is one of the foremost fintech funds in the UK. And Christophe Chazot is our swaps trader, head of innovation at HSBC now.
Like King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. You guys are running everything, Nigel.
Laurent Graff is a similar FI 360 degree sales relationship management role at Barclays. where he's seeing the need for a lot of technology, so he's a big supporter of the Techstars Accelerator program. A lot of us all grew up there. It's like Swiss Bank Corps, a lot of us grew up there and came out and changed. And there's Dresdner Kleinwort was a hotbed of wonderful technology innovation at its time for such a small bank, when you compare it to Goldman, Lehman and all those guys, that it's created a bunch of guys who just had that experience. And it was a great experience because, to be honest, it wasn't a great bank. So you had to have another edge to be able to get product into people.
Absolutely. It's interesting how there are these small networks. I mean, the other one comes across is the sort of Betfair people, people who worked at Betfair in the early 2000s, which was kind of fintech without the fin in a sense. And there's diaspora from that all over the place.
Sean Park was one of the angel investors in Betfair.
Right, well, there we go. So there's all these mafia networks, actually. So you're getting the whole thing because you were actually living the life and walking the walk and talking the talk long before all this sort of more indie stuff happened. So one day you're working in a... Well, you say it's a sort of niche, but it was still probably about sort of 75,000 people were niche company. And then you find yourself in a smaller company. So what was the transition there?
A huge raft of us all left in 2007 from Dresdner
Kleinwort. You saw the crash coming and got out of the top.
It's all in the papers as well. There's a whole load of great stories around the various court cases going on at the time, from employees not being paid a bonus, all that
type of thing. Oh, I see you were one of those. Yes, I did read it in the Evening Standard, wondering who these people were.
A wonderful one. There's a colleague who's Australian who managed to win the court case because he claimed they were being discriminatory against an Australian.
Oh, wow.
and he actually won that case.
So it answers the question, what are lawyers for, yes.
Yes, but anyway, the whole raft of us all left in 2007. I was living in France at the time, and I was on the phone trying to exchange from euros to pounds. And there was a company called HRFX, a great company, who were trying to charge me like 4.5%.
And you had your Richard Branson moment. And you thought, I'm going to buy my own aeroplane.
Who was the guy who did the razor? Remington.
Right, okay.
He said, I like the shave so much, I bought the company.
Okay, well, Branson did that. He was trying to go on holiday and then he couldn't get off some island or something.
Oh, I didn't
realize
that.
So he chartered a plane.
Yes.
He and his wife for that. And then he said to everyone, look, do you want to come on my plane? You know, I've chartered it. Oh, I'll do that again. Which is roughly, presumably what you did.
Okay.
After you changed your 1,000 euros into sterling for 4.5%, you thought you could do it for less than 4.5%.
And then they sent through an email, which is good. And that email had a PDF in it, which I then had to write on it with physical ink and then had to fax it back to them. I didn't have a fax, so I had to go into the local village to find the tobacco shop, which had a fax in it, to send it back to them to get my settlement. I thought, hey, this is a overpriced industry outside this whole straight through processing world I was working in for the past 10-15 years. So I thought, well, let's look at the foreign exchange payments world for the 1 euro up to 500,000 euro market, which is people sending money back and forth, small corporates doing business. And can we apply what we did in high volume flow trading that we did in the banks to this business?
Interesting. So I've forgotten the book that I read, Build, Design, Float or something, I can't remember. Anyway, what this chap says, who's a biotech entrepreneur in Oxford, is that the best businesses come from personal pain. So
yes.
Whether it's the Remington or the Virgin Airline or yours, you know, if you're experiencing a personal pain in life, then chances are you ain't the only one who's experiencing that personal pain. And if you can solve that personal pain, then you're going to build a big business. I mean, a lot of businesses tend, we'll come onto the venture capital bit at the end, but a lot of businesses tend to come in from the opposite these days. Oh, it's a strategic, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. That's fine, it can work out. But equally, if you're going through some pain and you can fix it, you don't really need to do the market research because you know other ones got the same pain.
Yeah, it's true.
Marcello Bravo.
That FX Capital Group, which is now today called Currency Cloud, that's where we set it up.
So when did FX Capital get set up then?
It's set up in 2007. What we built is we built the platform. I got a friend, Nick Borner, who is, I met at Swiss Bank Corp. I've been working with him 15, 16 years. And he worked for me at Evolution as well. New FX for back of his hand. He'd sort of semi-retired out of the technology world and has become a Charlene's herbalist and acupuncturist.
Oh, cool.
So I phoned him up and said, can you come back and do technologies?
Leave your needles at home.
His first answer began with F and
his next
word is, oh no, basically. So I started working on him.
So you needled him some more, ha ha.
Yes. All he said then was, as long as I can do it at Macintoshes, so that was a deal.
Okay.
So we were one of the first financial services firms to be fully Mac only, including all our back end and everything. Although I do remember JP Rangaswamy coming, when I first joined Dresdner Kleinwort, coming into the management office on the trading floor. So Nigel, pleased to meet you, JP, and we talked about, did you know Al Noor and all the Swiss Banker guys. He said, Nigel, what I'd love to do is put a Macintosh on every single trading desk on the floor here because it just looks so much cooler. And I thought, this guy is somebody I can work with.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a CIO we can definitely work with. And he's subsequently been a good friend of both investors and Antimus as well.
That's really cool. So that's literally the story. We've missed a bit out in the middle, but your chief executive will be on the show soon to talk about the currency cloud bit. But literally, it went from a fax machine in some tiny little shop to $10 billion of turnover, which is pretty impressive.
It was a slow start, to be honest, and actually Mike was a catalyst to really grow that business. And what we discovered was we were trying to build a better brokerage, so we were in the better mousetrap business.
But this is interesting, because the pressing pause, so you weren't trying to build a cheaper mousetrap, because the original pain had been 4.5% plus
yes.
It was a pile of hassle, I guess.
Yes. So we're solving a hassle with straight-through processing, so automation, basically. We're solving the pricing by being able to automate. You could draw a load of price out. We're solving the pricing issue by giving 100% transparency, because the retail market and the small SME market had no transparency of what an FX rate was.
Pressing pause there, because I hear the word transparency in all sorts of silos in fintech, and it always ends up meaning something slightly different.
Oh,
and it doesn't always mean complete transparency in the way that if you walk around naked, you are pretty transparent.
There's the emperor's new clothes transparency.
Yes.
I'll put it in the foreign exchange context. You see everywhere commission-free foreign exchange. All the brokers are advertising that and everything. Yes, it's commission-free above the markup that they already put on the wholesale price. Yeah. So there's a wholesale price, there's a retail price, and the retail price doesn't have any commission on it, which is a complete and utter lie, because you've got the difference in the wholesale and the market price. So what we did, we told everybody how much we market up. We were allowed to market up because we're in business. So you're clear and you make a conscious decision as a consumer, whether it's consumer or SME, to that was a good price or not. We were one of the first people to make transparency of foreign exchange prices. Now, the brokerage market is also a declining game. And that's where we noticed that prices all tend to zero. Because we had great technology, because the pricing was in the spread, the difference between the markup, the wholesale rate and the retail rate, even though it's transparent, people didn't attribute any value to our wonderful technology platform, which does all the straight through processing, etc. So the concept of broker meant that you were trapped in a brokerage mindset, and everybody hates their broker. It's
yeah.
a natural thing. And always wants to fight on price just because they want to win a few points off you type of thing.
I read something on that recently, by the way, about, this is a useful tip, no doubt from sort of Evening Standard or something, probably wasn't, but anyway, which is that if you're in a salary negotiation with another person, it's been shown that you do better by quoting them a range, yeah?
Yes.
If I say, Nigel, you're a great guy, I'll give you 10 million.
Mm.
You'll say, get out of bed for that, you know, make it 15 or something.
Yes.
But however, if I say to you, look, you're a great guy, Nigel, and the range for this job is 6 to 10, and I'm prepared to pay you 10.
The psychology of it, yes.
It's amazing, yeah.
One of the big learning things from that was brokerage is not the game to be in. And we had great technology, and essentially Currency Cloud now is a technology business, and you've got to express the value of the technology to the customer.
So how did you do that then? It's a very clever trick, isn't it?
Change your name.
Okay, good.
Hence, we changed from FX Capital Group, which is a very broker name, into the Currency Cloud. Mike Laven, given total credit for this, said we're a payments business now, we're not a foreign exchange business. And payments had a different connotation, non-brokerage type of connotation. And we repositioned the pricing, etc., of the offering to show value in the platform and the technology and the service rather in the foreign exchange and the fees on the payment side. So that was a big transition which we did throughout 2011 as we raised our capital. And I brought Mike in at the beginning of 2012. And then we reposition the business to be payments and technology.
That's fascinating, because I'm just really reflecting on this sort of siloitis, both in the old financial services and new financial services, that people really do get into siloed thinking. So when I joined group management in 1992, above all the silos, it was amazing how within corporate finance they had one kind of mentality, within treasury,
yes.
another, et cetera, et cetera. And on last week's podcast with Philippe Gellis from Cantox, I was talking to him about how this applies in fintech today. So what P2P means within FX fintech is very, very different from what it means within lending and borrowing fintech. So, for example, in lending and borrowing fintech, it's very, very kosher, although rumoured, that if you've got too many lenders that you put it on somebody else's platform, heaven forbid, that's very, very naughty. Whereas in FX P2P, it happens all the time. Deals can't be done on a P2P basis. You put it out to the market, and that's never been thought of as strange. So there are these little sort of cultural differences.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting, we bring up Cantox and Transferwise, both those guys, when they very first started the company, were introduced to me by a company called Mangrove VC, which is a guy called Michael Jackson, Not the singer. But actually, at the time, Michael Jackson, who wasn't Michael Jackson, Eric Clapton was our accountant. Which was using anecdote on the side. Eric Clapton is a good old Essex boy and accountant, so rather than a legendary guitarist. Both those guys said, yeah, we're going to do peer-to-peer. And Michael said, can you have a chat with these guys? Because you've got the grey hair and you know about foreign exchange, you know about trading, you know about markets and things.
And for those people that don't know, this was a very useful chat.
It was a very useful chat. They said, it's all going to be peer-to-peer. So you say, well, what price is your entries, guy? And because different times and price, you've got to book it at different prices.
And going back to transparency is the question of the time of the trade as well, which isn't always thought of in fintechy sugar and spice articles.
And generally, the reason exchange exists is you're always skewed one way or the other. So peer-to-peer in foreign exchange payments or forwards, as Cantox guys are doing, you can probably get away with it in a high volume currency like euro, sterling and dollar. Yeah. Can only get around between 20-25% peer-to-peer. The rest of it, you need a traditional market maker or the market, which is what Currency Cloud provided those services essentially to them. So you can always match, and they had to explain the issues of he's buying five, this person's selling one, who's going to make up the other four? That's another use case when a market maker comes in. Or he's selling five, nobody's coming in, so you need the market maker. So those type of dynamics of a market actually works, because those guys are great businessmen as well, they've built great businesses. To expose the sort of grey hair, the difference between a fintech guy who's also got fin and tech, as opposed to just tech.
Yes.
And that is where fintech, I think, is an expression of the market. Too much tech, you don't realise the regulatory piece, the market piece, how it transacts.
This is what I mean when I say that fintech isn't tech. And as Philippa said last week, it's very hard to think of a successful fintech that's been set up just by a tech person.
Yes. Yeah.
Because fin is much, much harder than it looks. I mean, we're talking about FX, Nigel, and we all know FX is really, really simple. I sell you some pounds and you give me some euros. I mean, what could be a simpler transaction? That has been going around for millennia. However, notwithstanding which, it would amaze anybody who hasn't been in it, the amount of detail you've got to get right to make it work.
It's interesting. What we also tried to do in Currency Cloud is give simplicity that I want to sell euros, buy pounds, I want it there. That's as simple as that. The market view of it is euro sterling is only open if you're doing it at certain times of day, so in the weekends it's shut. Or if you've got more esoteric currencies, they only trade at certain hours. The settlement times, have you bought it today, tomorrow, spot, forward? All that terminology, which is all market terminology we all brought up in. And that is the complexity that you take out to, that's what Currency Cloud and Cantox and TransferWise, everybody took out. Say, I want money between here, this currency, selling that one, I want it there.
Yeah, and you gave them some sort of brokerage-y API called payments.
Yes, yes.
Excellent.
So it's not so much a shell game of changing the thing, but the culture of the firm also. Another learning thing was when we were raising our capital with Atlas Ventures, Antimus and others in 2011 at Currency Cloud, and bringing what guy do you want to bring in to run the firm? And it's different to a technology guy who understands fin, which is Mike Laven, and he understands extremely well, or to bring a fin guy who understands technology. And the other one, that was a colleague of mine who ran equity sales at Citibank, then ran MF Global as chief exec of Europe, and then was chief exec of Cantors in Europe. And the problem with the too much fin guy, it would be a brokerage again.
It's a blend, isn't it?
Yeah, a total tech guy. There's one other guy I was looking at who was from Oracle, but didn't have enough fin. And getting that skew of enough tech, they really understood tech and understood the economics of a tech and the positioning of tech, but really knew fin.
It reminds me of claret. I mean, the red wine from the Bordeaux region. The art is all in the blend, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
You can't make it with any one of the grapes on its own because it ain't claret.
Yes.
Anymore.
Very true.
So you made some nice claret.
If you're calling Mike Laven claret.
Yes. He's like a jolly good claret. He's maturing with age.
No, but seriously, I mean, Mike was one of the few people in the market who actually understood this. And I mean, he's been on both sides, pure tech and on the financial side of hedge fund world and other things. He has got the grey hair to understand those things, which was important.
No, absolutely. And I've said it for a long time before I got remotely near actually knowing much about it at all, but it always struck me last year when I was really getting into the fintech that, as I've mentioned, I'm not being flattering because it's on previous episodes, Currency Cloud for me has always been the fintech's fintech. You know, it's the one who people who really understand fintech, they really respect, which isn't to diss anybody else, but it's just to say that, in a sense, Currency Cloud perhaps is the first one that I would really call financial services player that's come out of the fintech world. Everyone else is kind of on the journey from startup through scale up or whatever, but hasn't kind of got there yet.
Yeah.
Anyway, just to divert you back to this question about the different sort of silos within the new financial services. So you've got the P2P and FX, as you explained, where you've got all these issues where the problem with P2P is that you're never going to match there at that point in time, and FX tends to be more at a point in time. And the FX P2Ps have come up with one approach to that. In the lending and borrowing, as I call it, they've never really got around what I always see as a fundamental problem, which is that if you're the CEO of a P2P lender and borrower, you wake up in the morning and go, oh, we've got too many lenders. Or you go, oh, we've got too many borrowers. Now, that used to happen when you were banks in Italy with your tables and that. And they solved it in their tables in Italy by, in a sense, what we would call in modern language, an interbank market.
Yes.
Oh, I've got too many things in my left hand today, Nigel. Oh, I've got too many things in your right. Tell you what, should we swap some?
Yes.
And that was what has really made banking as successful it's been for centuries, that kind of thing. And I do keep wondering, and I've never actually thought of the answer yet myself, I do keep wondering kind of what P2P lending and borrowing needs of a similar mechanism. It's almost like within market liquidity. Now, nobody ever talks about that, so maybe it's a crazy thing, but you can see where I'm coming from.
Totally right. The peer-to-peer lending is of interest when banks aren't lending to people. You've got a liquidity issue, which is essentially the market. So you can then facilitate, and there's no yield coming from banks. There's other places to get some yield on your cash and things. The issue I have of peer-to-peer lending is when we get another market crash, the liquidity side normally goes, default side goes up, everybody's actually, there's no sort of underwriting guarantees like you get in a bank. So my view of peer-to-peer lending is those platforms are great for originating loans. They're great for risk managing a small size portfolio of loans. So they can make, come back to flow trading, what we did in digital markets. It's a great mechanism for servicing retail and SME lending. So you put a bank balance sheet in there to get proper liquidity, and then you sort out the normal ways that banks lend to each other when they're long or short.
So maybe I should cut this bit out of the podcast, because it then occurs to me that what we should do, Nigel, is go off and set up the equivalent of what Currency Cloud was for the peer-to-peer online lending and borrowing space.
I think that's going on.
Right.
I think if you look at the peer-to-peer lending space and the discussions that are happening in various of those firms.
Well, this is so-called institutional money, which of course drives the whole thing in America. But again, just cultural things, that's a slightly different thing in terms of culture, and that the culture, as I understand it, is more of an investment. Oh, we've got these funds, we'll just invest it in the platform, as opposed to what you were doing with Currency Cloud, which is providing a service.
Yes.
And then actually the other business acquisition vehicles came along and actually wanted to use your service.
So essentially, what we did at a really high level, we made transaction banking, which is foreign exchange payments and receipts, an API, a simple API that you can build. Like Fido Bank went live with the Currency Cloud in 2 weeks.
Wow.
Try and do that with Swift, Fix, and all the other big technologies that you use in the institutional world. So if you then take a bank, make it a set of APIs in front of the bank, so there's a lending API, credit, transaction banking, securities, custody.
The UK Treasury is a bit obsessed with that at the moment.
Yeah. Then go to the world, and same with what Steve Jobs did with it and Johnny Ives did with the iPhone, and said, here's something that can make phone calls, it can transfer data, it's got a GPS on it, here's a bunch of APIs, go make stuff, because you'll invent it, I won't, and I'll put a security around it, I'll put other things and stuff, I'll make it shiny so it's nice, and make it simple. So if we do that to the banking world, then you've got peer-to-peer guys who can originate stuff better for the banks. So the banks really become wholesale
warehouses of credit.
Warehouses of credit.
And liquidity.
And liquidity and safety, which
absolutely
a lot of the fintech misses, I think, that concept of trust and safety.
This is the other thing that, you know, we've spoken about before, which is the necessity for the so-called disruptive fintechs, not a phrase I like, but anyway, I like to call it new FS, for the new FS players to become financial services. And to become financial services, you need to be solid, you need to be reliable, and you need to have people in your firm with the kind of backgrounds that we've got who really know what liquidity means in their bones and know what lack of liquidity means in their bones, as opposed to, oh, I read this on Wikipedia kind of stuff. And I'm not being rude.
No, you're
like,
totally
if
right.
If you live it 20, 30 years,
yes.
I mean, I remember trying to sell some bonds once to Morgan Stanley, 88, or some crash, there's always crashes going on. Morgan Stanley didn't pick up the telephones, you know. I remember that for a long, long time.
Mm.
And I needed to sell it. That kind of, oh my God,
yes.
The lift cable has been cut. That thing never goes away. You can't forget that.
No, you don't. I mean, I think the grey hair or no hair.
Yeah, exactly. That's what comes as it. Maybe we shouldn't have worked in financial services.
In fact, they got the Russian default one on .com, boom and bust.
87 crash I went through.
Crash, all those things going through them, and you got Nick Taleb making money out of every single one of those black swan events. It's understanding when things do go wrong. You've got to accept it. And it's lovely working in the bull market, but there's crashes. there is, the bear comes running out the cave and sort of goes boo to you. So being able to see how you plan through that, and that's why my issue with the peer-to-peer is another big crash, which may happen and may not, but the liquidity goes up, everybody gets upset because there's no real regulation behind it, there's no real safety.
And you can't get out of your trades. So one of the other problems with the peer-to-peer lending and borrowing is if you've stuck some money in a five-year deal or whatever, then the details on all of them are that, oh yes, you can put your stuff there, and if someone else is buying, then you'll get your money back. But the bit for me that says, if someone else is buying, I'll go, well, hang on, maybe they aren't 3 years' time.
Yes.
Then I can't get my money back.
Yep.
That's quite key. And I think, actually, I'll come back to this spray painting cars versus spray painting the dog. And certainly one of the things I quite like about the FX market in fintech is that it is more like financial services for a very simple reason. Currency cloud is at the hub of this because it has to interface with financial services.
Yes.
It has to deal on the same basis. Whereas P2P lending and borrowing doesn't have to interface.
Oh, it does. It does.
Okay. Well, look, it moves money around bank accounts.
Yes. You mentioned the word disruption. I don't think banks get disrupted. Banks fail. Yes.
Well, then we have to bail them out.
Then we've got to bail them out, yes. And that's because of poor management, poor risk management.
Poor management of the economy and government as a whole, really.
And also, I think some of the banks run at the time of people who didn't understand risk or risk management in the banks and didn't have a risk culture. They had a corporate finance culture as opposed to a trader culture.
But I'd argue that hasn't got any better because we've just got a compliance culture now. You go to a bank, well, we're taking all the boxes, we're doing the risk.
Oh, I agree with you. Totally agree with you. I think we had offline conversations about the risk culture needs to be a bit better on that. But, for example, for a personal thing, my great-great-grandfather was the general manager of what today is called ANZ, and this is back in the mid-1800s, around 1847 or so. And you can still Google him and find him. His apartments in the ANZ head office are still there. They've gone through wars. They've gone through political change. They've gone through more than dot-com bust and boom.
Yeah.
They've gone through prohibition, all those things, and ANZ is still here. So the reason is because financial services are very much a trust-based organisation.
Similar to Rothschilds.
Yes.
The name Rothschild has meant something for quite a long time.
Long time. So the old traditional banks, and I think what we're seeing now, as you quite rightly call it, new FS, is a new way of distributing the same balance sheet, the same safety and everything, rather than trying to disintermediate it. Because all the peer-to-peer lenders have to have a bank account. Okay, you can say Bitcoin could avoid all that, but that is like, that's toxic.
It's not good on that.
Okay. You still need to work with them. Currency Cloud has to work with the banks, not fight them.
No, exactly. It's corporate compete. It's a traditional model.
And I had a wonderful mentor, a guy called Sir Robert Malpass, who's my chairman of Evolution that the firm I built before. Great guy. He's like in his 80s now. But he's a chairman of Eurotunnel, Cookson, on the main board of BP, non-exec of Repsol, real industry guy. And he just said, Nigel, one of the key things you've got to do is create coincidence of purpose between when your customers, yourselves, and society and things. And that's what I view what Currency Cloud is achieving with the banks, is creating coincidence of purpose.
Or alignment of interest.
Yeah. Keep them aligned. We're coming on to Orange Growth Capital. From an investment thesis, we don't believe in disruption. We believe in coincidence of purpose.
So let's come on to OGC because time's going on. So you've done all these fascinating things brilliantly well, and now you've become a venture capitalist. But I thought that snigger, snigger, when VCs aren't in the room, everyone goes, oh, we hate the VCs. So why have you turned to the dark side, Nigel? Not that I'm equating VC with dark side, of course.
It's a good point, though. Because I was one of those guys going snigger,
exactly.
Snigger.
Exactly, exactly. Yes.
No, it's a very good question. In 2014, I spent a lot of time doing some mentoring in Techstars, Barclays Accelerator, Startup Bootcamp, FinTech, seeing a whole load of really energetic people who did have fin and did have tech, and they were skewed one way or the other in there. And I was also looking at setting up another firm as well, which I was considering, and I worked with a couple of colleagues as well, because Mike was doing a phenomenal job of running Currency Cloud, so it's best get out of his way and let him get on with his great work. So the decision was, do I want to build another company again, or do I want to do something else? And thinking through that, it's been an operator for the past, whatever, 25 years. It gives you grey hair or no hair.
It's either having daughters, but that's another conversation entirely.
Yes. Or invest in these kids who've got the energy, and I call them kids because they're in their 20s and 30s, but they're still very responsible individuals, or invest in them. And I was lucky enough to meet Radboud and Renier from Orange Goes Capital. We've got the same views. We're not from a sort of investor background. We're from operator background, and we're from advisory background and early stage VC when the guys are working there and transactions.
So you're not really VCs?
Not really VCs, but I mean, you've got to question, what is a VC? And if you look in the US, there's great ex-entrepreneurs who are VCs. UK tends to be more ex-corporate financiers and accountants who are VCs. That skewed it. And I think the Europe is coming more like US. You've got to have a balance because you need that sort of different view on things. So I thought, well, they've got the energy. These guys are in their 20s and 30s to go and do stuff.
Yeah.
I get a bit tired of chasing guys.
Funny you say that, I'm a grey hair now here, because somebody approached me recently and said, I would like to be chief executive of this business. I thought, well, it sounds a bit like hard work, actually. and again, I'm perfectly capable of doing hard work, and I've done far too much hard work on this podcast or whatever. But that kind of hard work that you've done many times over, you do get to the stage where actually you're better off passing on some of your expertise and all that and just letting them do the sweating, because they're just fitter and faster.
It's like a rugby team, football team, whatever. Once you pass a certain age, you then become a coach, or you can become an advisor, and you help them strategically win, game plan, etc., and try and put their advice back in the economy, back into people.
Absolutely. It's the most appropriate shape. When I joined the city, I got a lot of useful advice from people with grey hair or no hair. And if they just kept sort of hugging the ball and running around with the ball themselves, I would never have got that, and I would never have caught on. So it's an important intergenerational transfer. So joking aside about VCs, I mean, just for those people who haven't heard of Orange Growth Capital, how would you position them in a few sentences, Nigel?
Very quickly, we're a specialist fintech investor. We operate in Europe, and we tend to work with companies, what is called in the industry Series A, or just pre-Series A type of investments. We're a new fund, and we're looking to grow out our investment portfolio across Europe, across different types of fintech.
Okay, and I'm sure you've got a problem even more than I have, which is that I didn't have this problem 8 months ago because nobody would be on the show, but now I get 10 people a day want to be on the show, and I'm sure you have the same thing. You've got sort of 10 companies a day say, oh, can you invest in us? We're a really good company. But what kind of companies should think about trying to contact you guys? If somebody listening out, because I mean, this goes out to sort of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people listening, there'll be some of them thinking, oh.
Again, it's fintech businesses, and we're open-minded to any type of fintech business. What we don't want is somebody who's got a business that is trying to pitch a photo sharing app just because it's got payments in it as a fintech business. That's what we don't want. So we're early stage. We don't invest in business plan. We invest just pre-series A, so prove they've got products, they prove they've been able to acquire some customers.
So the aeroplane has actually taken off the runway, even if it's just above the trees, it actually has got into the air.
It's proven into the air, and it's proved it's come around and landed once.
Oh, right, okay.
But we work with people and happy to talk to people to understand their business, what they're doing, and spend time with people, because we're putting it into the economy, into the entrepreneurs, to see how they work, because that's a big thing for me, is seeing how people work together, how can we work with them, that type of thing.
Yes, well, I met Radbud, your colleague, last year, and he's got a very, very solid McKinsey's background. And certainly for people who are listening, I'd think it would be a prize amongst prizes to end up working with these guys, literally because they have got the grey hair and no hair, and as you've just demonstrated, Nigel, the last sort of 40 minutes or so, an enormous depth of background in this whole sector. And I can see that that is the kind of stuff that would make you a kind of non-VC VC, and that, you know, there's real value to be added. Because, of course, the criticism of VC is the average return in the UK and Europe and in the States over the last 10 years has been 1%. And, you know, meanwhile, they take 2% per annum and take loads of money themselves. But the answer to which is, of course, all businesses have to add value, whether it's currency, cloud or OGC. And it's entirely obvious that you guys have got immense value to add. So I wish you luck in that venture, Nigel. And I loved hearing the story. I think I really related to this sort of spray painting of cars and how pertinent that's been to the theme of what you've done, which is always to execute well in a market where there's lots of details to execute. And there's plenty of fintechs out there who I think are lacking that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mike. Very complimentary.
Very good. And you've been so nice, I'm even going to edit this properly and not shuffle your words around. Thank you very much.
And thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app. Or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. are wild, like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.